Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
This is Louis Satchmo Armstrong talking to all the kids from all over the world.
On the Savage Nation.
Christmas time. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring. Not even a mouse.
What a voice.
Hello, baby.
What a voice.
I don't understand. You've been playing greater than ever.
Oh, thank you there, Deanie.
Can I ask you something? Yeah. Deanie, how old are you? Tell me the truth. How old are you? How old are you?
Oh, I'll be 65 this year anyway.
Okay. I don't understand.
65.
No, what I'm
listening
trying
to the great Louis Armstrong with Dean Martin.
Every time you play that horn, you break the sound barrier, you know? And Harry James is a much younger man. He can't even break a Kleenex. Now, Lou, what do you say you and me, we do a couple numbers together?
Okay, if the sound barrier is ready, I am ready.
Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Maybe we're a Dixie
Melody. Melody. What an incredible time it was to live in America. I would say 1900 to 1950 was the peak of the United States of America. Well, excuse me, 1950 to 2000. Sorry, I was off by 50 years. Were the greatest years in American history. From 50 to 2000, it's been downhill ever since. Actually, been downhill since Allen Ginsberg was born. Well, if you throw in Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I would say you could count that as part of it. Welcome to the Savage Nation. We're not doing the night before Christmas. We are doing... Well, I don't know, what is it, a few days before Christmas on the Savage Nation, and I have so many things to do and so many things to tell you about today that I'm just bubbling over with enthusiasm. And, of course, the phone lines are always open to you since it's a talk show, the third largest talk show in America, the second largest on the Internet. Did you hear about that? The Michael Savage Show is the number two show in the world of talk radio in the United States of America. That's pretty amazing. And if you care to call the program at any time, it's 1-800-449-8255. Now, I open tonight with Louis Armstrong. I just happened to last night, I was in San Francisco, go to a German restaurant that I go to once in a while for a couple of drinks. It's very cheerful around this time of year, filled with younger people. For some reason, the younger people are gravitating to European-style restaurants this time of year. They want the baked goose or the this or the that. Mainly they want the booze, and it's a lot of fun to be around vicariously enjoying their hijinks. It's a lot of fun and not too noisy. So he's playing this CD, Louis Armstrong, Dean Martin, goofing around in the studio, particularly with that thing Gone Fishing, where they're really goofing around about, you know, the women that were in their lives, the extramarital or the women in general. I don't really know, but you can tell that's what the Gone Fishing thing is about. And it was really quite funny. For those of you who are more traditional, we have Come All You Faithful by Bing Crosby, but nevertheless, the music is just fabulous. At the same time, I told you I'm writing... two books. I'm writing a sequel to Abuse of Power with Jack Hatfield's next adventure. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read you a piece of that today on the Savage Nation, believe it or not. I know I shouldn't, but I will. And I'm finishing up Trickle Down Tyranny, which will be out in March or April from Harper's as my sequel to Trickle Up Poverty, just in time for the major primaries. Trickle Down Tyranny, I think you can get the picture, especially since one of the world's greatest tyrants just died, and he was glorified by Jimmy Carter and those in the press. Astounding that a crypto commie like Jimmy Carter would glorify Kim Jong-il and send his regards, a man who starved millions of people to death, and Jimmy Carter apparently doesn't know the difference between Kim Jong-il and George Washington. I will talk about that on the Savage Nation. So anyway, there's a lot of amazing stories out there. In the middle of it all, since I'm writing the book, the sequel to Abuse of Power, don't worry, I'll do the news. There's plenty of news to talk about, all the corruption that you want to hear about, but not quite yet. I have to tell you that I'm inspired by 1940s and 50s film noir movies in terms of the dialogue, the interaction, the fast dialogue, the give and take between characters in movies in the 30s and 40s were at a zenith of screenwriting. And a lot of it had to do with one screenwriter named Ben Hecht. I, of course, didn't know him. I was a baby at the time. But I look back on some of these movies, such as His Girl Friday by Ben Hecht, the screenplay, or Scarface, the 1932 Scarface screenplay by Ben Hecht, and you listen to the dialogue, and you ask yourself, how does this work? Explain this to me. You've had millions upon millions of people going to college in America, K-A-L-I-D-G-E, learning how to put a condom on a cucumber and how to hate America and hate the police and hate the military and hate their mother and father and hate George Washington. And they become less literate than the boys and girls of America or who went to high school in the 1930s and 40s. How does that work? Well, the answer is because they've been brainwashed by state-run schools that are nothing but propaganda factories except in the hard sciences. There's nothing but social engineering and hard propaganda, and the children come out less literate than those who went to high school in the 30s and 40s. How do you explain that this country was filled with immigrants, mainly European immigrants, by the way, in the 30s, in the 40s, new immigrants to America, and yet the literacy level of the screenplays was so high compared to the illiteracy or alliteracy, let's put it that way, the alliteracy of today's Spielberg-esque dreck that comes out of the idea factories of the worst the world has ever offered. How do you explain that? Okay, it's interesting. So I have clips from some of these movies. We have sound from Christmas songs from Bing Crosby, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, and Louis Armstrong. I have a snippet of my new novel, the sequel to Abuse of Power, which I will read to you a little later on. I actually wrote it last night. I went to the city, as I said to you. So after I had a few beers, I walked over to a skating rink in San Francisco in Justin Herman Plaza, where they just kicked the fetid stinking bums called Occupy out of the plaza. They finally sprayed it down and got rid of the germs and the disease and the feces that the most useless citizens of America left behind. And every year they create a skating rink similar to the one in Rockefeller Center in New York. I love this time of year in San Francisco. And I sometimes go by and hang on the rail and watch the children and the mothers and the daddies skating around the rink. And it doesn't bring back memories. It gives me memories. How's that? It doesn't bring back memories because I didn't ice skate. I'm not from Curia and I'm not from Ives. I'm from the Bronx. But it gives me memories, new memories that I really favor. And so I want to read you. Teddy, stop it. You're disrupting the show. That's Teddy's growl just now. I don't know why my dog is growling. He shouldn't be. He knows the show started and he's supposed to sleep. You got a belly full of roast beef, Teddy. Just lay there and enjoy the show. So here's what I wrote last night, and this is going to be in the next novel, the sequel. But the place was more than that. It was on the route he used to take to go to Justin Herman Plaza, where they created a skating rink similar to the one in Rockefeller Center in New York. 2 years ago, when Jack had broken up with Rachel in the fall, he had faced a lonely Christmas season. Since he didn't have a wife or family of his own, he would go to the rink and hang on the rail at night and watch the children with their mothers and fathers skating around the ice like little fledglings learning to walk beside their parents. He would watch with a vicarious contentment as a mother would place her little daughter in between her legs, pushing her around the ice with her knees turned in to prop her up. Jack marveled at how much it was like the animal kingdom. At some point, though, he would usually have to turn away, tearing up, thinking of his own mother and how she had taught him so much, how to walk, how to dance, how to tie his tie, how to talk to a lady, among other things. Like most strong men, Jack never talked about her. What could he say that wouldn't sound sentimental and false? But her life had enriched him beyond calculation, and her death had hit him like a fist in the gut. Well, anyway, that's a few paragraphs from my next sequel to Abuse of Power, so you could see of the making of many books, there is no end. And by the way, there's a tremendous ruling that is going to make my life more joyful than it's been for about 18 years now. A ruling just came out with a $2.5 million libel judgment against a blogger who smeared somebody on a blog and then tried to hide behind a shield law which allows journalists to protect confidential sources. But Judge Marco Hernandez ruled that this person was not a journalist and therefore not entitled to the protections. Therefore, she lost a $2.5 million lawsuit. So all of you who've been slandering me and libeling me and smearing me on the internet, get ready because you're going to have some mail coming in the next few months. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Hang in my stocking. I can hear him knocking. Is that you, Santa Claus? Sure is dark out. Ain't the slightest spark.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation, little Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong, from Louis Armstrong to rap music in one generation, the degeneracy of America. Let me ask you something. We're going to soon play some clips from 1930s and 40s movies, real fast dialogue written by Ben Hecht. I'm going to ask a question. How have people gotten stupider in America instead of smarter? Wouldn't you think with all the kids that went to college, K-O-L-I-D-G-E, which is probably how they spell it, they all went to college. What'd they major in? SOS 101, Family 109, Anti-American 103, Hate the Police and Military 104. Why are they stupider? How is it that high school graduates in the 30s and 40s would go to these movies and follow this repartee, this fast dialogue that was quicker than a tennis game, and come out inspired by it, wanting to be like the actors? Instead, today, they go to the movies, and there's not one that inspires a child to be anything except a junkie, a degenerate, an America hater, or a loser. Why is that? How about the movies of the 40s that glorified our troops in World War II, all the way through the early 50s, Audie Murphy to Hell and Back? And take a look at what's happened since the spawn of Spielberg hit Hollywood. Every movie is an anti-war movie. Since the spawn of Spielberg hit the movies, every criminal is a hero and every cop is a crook. Since the spawn of Spielberg invaded Hollywood and injected their poison into the body politic and into the mind of America. And you ask yourself how this happens. It happens because the movies shape more of the public mind than anything on earth. So I want to play for you a piece of a script. Which one is this, Beowulf? This is Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell in the movie His Girl Friday. Listen to this. Again, the screenplay is by the incomparable Ben Hecht. Listen to this.
You're a newspaper man.
That's why I'm quitting. I want to go someplace where I can be a woman.
You mean be a traitor?
A traitor? A traitor to what?
A traitor to journalism, girl. A journalist, Hildy.
A journalist? Hell, what does that mean? Peeking through keyholes? Chasing after fire engines? Waking people up in the middle of the night to ask them if Hitler's going to start another war? Stealing pictures off old ladies? I know all about reporters, Walter. A lot of Daffy Budinskys running around without a nickel in their pockets. And for what? So a million hired girls, motorman's wives will know what's going on?
Well, you get the picture. It's unbelievable how fast this is. In the next clip, is this any good? Okay, go. Now, the next one is a clip from the 1932 drama Flim. If I actually start speaking the speed I normally speak at, if I actually started speaking the speed I used to speak at when I was a kid in the Bronx, you wouldn't follow a word I said. So therefore, I have to speak in the ordinary speed of my language on the Savage Nation so that I can be heard by the millions of faithful listeners. So let's listen to the 1932 film drama, Scarface, screenplay again by the great Ben Hecht.
Listen to me. You come into this town, you think you're headed somewhere, don't you? You think you're going to get there with a gun, but you're not. Get me? You know why? Because you got $1,000 bills pasted right across your eyes. And someday you're going to stumble and fall down in the gutter, right where the horses have been standing, right where you belong.
You got me all figured out, eh?
I've spent my life mixing with your breed, and I don't like it, get me? You can hide behind a lot of red tape, crooked lawyers, some politicians with the gimmies, writs of habeas corpus, witnesses that don't remember overnight, but we'll get through to you just like we got all the rest.
Oh, maybe me, I'm different.
No, you're not. Take your gun away and get you in a tough spot, and you'll squeal like all the other rats.
That's a police chief character telling off criminal Tony Camonte, played by Paul Muni. Again, notice the differential between the policeman, the police chief, and the criminal. Clear as a bell for the audience. The police chief hated the criminal. The police chief was not ambivalent about the criminal. The policeman despised him and told him he was a piece of garbage and he would get him. And today, what do you have? Today, in the spawn of Spielberg's Hollywood, what do you have? Why the criminal is misunderstood. Why the criminal is secretly a jazz saxophonist who takes care of young children on the side. Why the criminal only went into it because of society's injustices. You see how it works? Sacramento, David, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Howard Hawks, the director of His Girl Friday, one of my personal favorite movies with Cary Grant. It's 180 pages long.
Now, wait, we just played Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell discussing acquitting as a reporter. Did you hear it?
Oh, yeah. But okay. It's 180 pages long. That's 30 seconds per page. If you think about it, that whole movie is just dynamic dialogue. Well,
so let me hear what you're saying. What is an average screenplay's length today?
Oh, it's 25 pages. It's mostly action. It's just stupid. I mean, the dialogue in film today is just...
Well, that's to make certain that the youth in America today can follow the narrative. We don't want to leave anyone behind. It's, after all, no idiot left behind today in the spawn of Spielberg's Hollywood.
I force my kids to watch the black and white films of the 40s.
But I have a more fundamental question. Why is it that people were smarter in the 30s and 40s, even though there was less education in the 30s? Does that explain it, that they were less brainwashed?
No, it doesn't. I think that America's dying for that dialogue again, that firecracker dialogue that's just...
So do I. I absolutely agree with you. You see, I don't think the audience has gone away for that kind of quick dialogue. I think that the idiots of Hollywood don't even understand who the American people are. They talk down to them, and they appeal to the lowest common denominator. Instead of creating a film script that people would go to and come out, you know, ennobled from it and wanting to remember some of the lines, they talk down to them. I agree with you. I don't think that a high-end script could get done, though, today. I doubt very much it could pass the censorship of the spawn of Spielberg. Because unless the script supports the iconic dreck that the spawn of Spielberg revel in or swim in, look, the sewer pipe of Hollywood only supports sewer material.
Savage.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas just like the ones I used to know.
Everybody in America loved Louis Armstrong. They didn't have to check a race book to see if it was okay. How come that was possible? No one had to check a book to see if it was okay to love a black singer because he was so talented. No one had to be told to listen to him because it would be politically appropriate to listen to him. They just loved him because of his talent, period, end of story. Which brings us back to where we are today. Kim Jong-il dies the other day, one of the worst dictators of all time, if not in scope, then in intent. Millions died under this maniac. And Jimmy Carter sends him condolences. The crypto-communist Jimmy Carter never met a dictator of the socialist variety he didn't respect. And, of course, he was once president of the United States, and he is a mentor of none other than our president today. Now, why am I talking about that? I have to get into the politics of this. I had to soften you up like a turkey given a goblet of gin before a slaughter. As I told you that story once when I used to spend a lot of time in the islands, which I did collecting plants. I met wonderful old colonials who were still hanging around the islands in those days. And one of them told me, he said, we learned from the British that we give our birds gin prior to the slaughter because it softens them up. I thought that was both cruel and interesting at the same time. But it's a good system to use in talk radio. So I've softened you up with a little of screenplays and a little Louis Armstrong and a reading from my forthcoming novel, a sequel to Abuse of Power. But I have to tell you what's bothering me. Here a guy dies, Kim Jong-il, one of the worst dictators of all time. Jimmy Carter lauds him and sends condolences to the young Kim. And I said, I can't unbelieve the country we're living in. The Associated Press says leader of North Korea dies instead of saying a disgusting, sick, psychotic, mass murderer, Kim Jong-il, dies. That would have been appropriate journalism because he was all of those things. But instead, in an attempt to play down the excesses of state-run systems, especially socialist state-run systems, the vermin at the Associated Press say, World says leader of North Korea dies. And not to be outdone, every newspaper follows along the lines of the jerks at the Associated Press. It's very dangerous because they shape the minds of millions upon millions of people every day. So today, on MichaelSavage.com, we have a lead story. Carter sends condolences to North Korea. Just take a look at Carter's crazy eyes. But underneath it is the most important story of the day, which is not that Holder says critics attacking him because of race. He's playing his last card. Eric Holder's playing the last card he has, which is the race card. It won't work anyway. 90 congressmen signed a letter demanding his impeachment or firing. The big story is how Kim Jong-il starved millions of people. And it was written by a gentleman, Jordan Weissman, for The Atlantic. Now, I don't have to tell you, The Atlantic is not a right-wing publication. The last I checked, it was fairly liberal. It's a fabulous article, and he says, what kind of disastrous economic policy results in the death by starvation of up to 3 million people in a nation with the population of Texas? I can't read you the article, but you could read the article. But he asks, how did one man starve a nation of roughly 23 million people and kill about 3 million people? And he answers, by clinging to a broken economic system designed to do little but ensure his own survival. What does it have to do with you and the price of potatoes? Everything. Everything, because that was a state-run system where the government controlled the growing and the sale of produce. Originally, they didn't, but they followed the Stalinist mode of the government taking control of agriculture, which resulted in not only the diminishment of the production, but a dysfunctional food distribution system, okay? And so people starved to death. And what I'm saying to you is directly related to what's going on in America right now. The battle right now in America is between the statists, meaning the Democrats, like Obama, like Pelosi, and like Reid, who want to control this economy from cradle to grave. And then you've got the Republicans who are doing a fairly poor job of explaining their message, which is the free market system, free market capitalism, and what it leads to. So I read that article, and you have to understand that there is a direct link between progressives and communists. There's a direct link between progressives, communists, and Stalinists. They're all in the same arc, in case you don't know it. It's very dangerous for you not to know it. And when you see these vermin laying in the gutters saying there's income inequality, you better understand that they will lead you to the death camps if you follow their advice. Listen to me. I know what I'm talking about, and you better learn what the history of the world is. So I read that article, and I read the blogs. I like to read the blogs that follow some of these articles. A lot of it's garbage, real dreck, you know, just stupid put-downs. But some of it is written by intelligent people, and I found the blog on crony capitalism under the Kim Jong-il debate going on about Obama, about Kim Jong-il, about state-run economies versus free market systems of the type that we have enjoyed in America since the beginning, until, of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came along and almost introduced the Stalinist nightmare on this country. I want to read it to you. So he says, who rigs the system for these geniuses? Criminals like Bonnie Frank and his community banking friends, to whom he steers bailout money, and his boyfriends at Fannie Mae. Obama has repaid Wall Street for giving him more money than any other president in history by bailing them out. Obama and Steve Rattner, the guy who bribed New York State pension officials so he could make millions managing pension money. Incidentally, I am not, I didn't write any of this. I am reading what was written by a blogger. Tell me if I'm wrong. And Steve Rattner, the guy who bribed New York State pension officials so he could make millions managing pension money, bailed out their cronies at the UAW with our money, and they have done nothing but lie about the financial results. GE, run by Obama's buddy Jeffrey Immelt, barely pays any income tax, but they make billions selling wind turbines to buyers who are using subsidies from the government. He goes on. The political class is the wealthiest segment of our society. Warren Buffett invested $5 billion in Goldman Sachs and publicly stated that he did so because he knew the federal government was going to bail them out. Now, the Fed keeps interest rates at essentially zero. It devalues our currency, which devastates the little guy trying to save for retirement or his children's education, but it allows Obama's cronies on Wall Street to obtain capital for almost nothing. The crony capitalism practiced by Democrats is repugnant. Solyndra was a payoff to Obama's liberal friends. The company, Kleiner Perkins, is full of limousine liberals who make hundreds of millions of dollars investing in so-called green industries that only make money because the liberals and state and federal governments subsidize them with the tax dollars of the producer class, as opposed to the idiots who are able to take a month off from their cushy unionized government jobs to occupy the Wisconsin state capitol. People like Tom Daschle spend decades increasing the size and scope of government and then cash in as lobbyists by selling access to the monster he helped create. Daschle's wife made millions as a lobbyist while Daschle was the Senate Majority Leader. Where the heck did Charles Rangel acquire the millions of dollars worth of real estate and stock that he failed to report in his financial disclosures? Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, sat on a military appropriation subcommittee that awarded companies controlled by her husband over $1.5 billion in government contracts. Nancy Pelosi and her husband invested in credit card companies, and she then passed favorable legislation for those same companies. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac brought our economy to its knees while Franklin Raines and Jamie Gorelick cooked the books and made millions. The mayor of Chicago even cashed in on Fannie Mae before he didn't let the crisis that he and his fellow idiot liberals created go to waste. The political class in this country, in Washington and Wall Street, are all limousine liberals who depend on the support of the dishonest and ignorant of America. Then he concludes, tell me if you agree. There isn't a dime's bit of difference between Kim Jong-il and Obama and his Marie Antoinette wife jetting around the world on five-star vacations, spending scores of millions of dollars, while the average Joe is worried if he'll keep his job. The only thing keeping the criminally incompetent Democrat politicians from doing as much damage to our country as their fellow leftists have done to North Korea is the Constitution, and they are doing everything they can to destroy that as well. That's a blog. So don't assume every blogger is an ignoramus who doesn't have an outlet. Some people are brilliant, and they read these articles, and they're as brilliant as the writers, and they know how to write, by the way. 1-800-449-8255. So he took control of the powers of the state, this idiot Kim Jong-il, and then he took control of rice and corn, and he decimated the farmable land. He decimated the distribution, and he starved the people to death. Don't forget armed guards stationed everywhere to prevent anyone from leaving North Korea. Armed guards stationed everywhere to prevent anyone from leaving. Sounds like the TSA, doesn't it? Sounds like the TSA. But at least we know Kim Jong-il ate well, and that his generals ate well. Very, very famous, by the way. And that must be why, what's her name? What's that woman's name, that creep, who I can't get enough of despising? Madeleine Albright went there and saluted him and called him an intelligent man who watched a lot of movies. This is the political class we had under Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright. Jimmy Carter sends him a condolence note. 1-800-449-8255. I'm going to go to a caller right now. Gino in Norfolk, Virginia. Go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, Mike. I'm a screenwriter, and I like to put a little bit in perspective. The average screenplay is between 90 and 120 pages, and each page roughly represents 1 minute of screen time. Studios right. Nowadays really cringe at 120-page screenplay. They want it to be 90 pages. It allows them to have more screenings in the theater. So while older films were fantastic, had a lot of banter with their dialogue back and forth, if you turn a screenplay to a studio nowadays with one or two pages of dialogue, it's going to hit the slush pile right away.
Well, okay, no, I know that. But the question is, why do the spawn of Spielberg hate dialogue?
Well, because dialogue eats up screen time. Screen time equals money, and money equals viewings at the theater. I mean,
well, wait a minute. You're telling me that if there was smart dialogue, people wouldn't go to the movie?
We know that film is a reflection of society, and we can obviously tell what society goes for, anti-American, dumbed-down films, 90 minutes long, structured into three acts, and it's pathetic.
But, what do you mean, saying just shooting, killing, burning, maiming, cursing, is that it? That's the best that the spawn of Spielberg can give us?
Well, I don't know if that necessarily represents Spielberg, but, I mean, yeah, that's what sells.
Well, they're at the head of the pyramid. The spawn of Spielberg are the czars of Hollywood. The Caesars of Hollywood determine what the peons get to watch. But I'm suggesting that in the 1930s and 40s, people had an average high school education, and they went to movies that were far more literate. So how do you explain that?
Well, unfortunately, when a studio head reads a screenplay that has dialogue as some of the clips that you were playing for us, that kind of borders melodrama, and that's kind of cringed on. because there's nothing on it that sells. Unfortunately.
So, all right. So you're arguing that fast dialogue would not sell. It has to be a goon shooting another goon, or a man torturing or murdering a woman, or one actor or another portraying themselves as a junkie with a needle in his arm, suffering in a bathroom. That's the average fare for the average American around Christmas time.
Unfortunately, with a 7-second edit, that's all that's really allowed. They don't have enough time for.
Well, okay, but what I'm saying is, it's because of the demented minds of the spawn of Spielberg. The czars of Hollywood have all the power in the world to permit more literate screenplays to be developed into movies, but they choose not to. Not solely because they're afraid it won't sell, but because they want to sell a certain message, Gino. And that message has to be the anti-hero. That message has to be the degenerate, the junkie, the criminal. The un-American, that has to be the hero today, Gino. You know it and I know it. And that's not because that's what the people would go to. When have you last seen a movie showing a Muslim as a bomber or as a terrorist? Answer, never. Do you know that since 9/11, not one movie has been produced by the spawn of Spielberg that shows terrorists for who they are? Not one movie has been shown like that because the spawn of Spielberg will not permit it to be produced? The only villains are allowed to be white skinheads who served in the U.S. military with tattoos. Why? Because the spawn of Spielberg are sick in the head. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Este fideles, lati triumphantes.
You're now playing a tune for the Christophobes in the audience. Who is this? Is, of course, Bing Crosby, isn't he? Silent Night. Traditional American Christmas music, long before the spawn of Spielberg took over every aspect of our lives, from music to images. They must go through the Caesars of Hollywood, and the Caesars in the togas of Brentwood, and the Caesars in the togas of the Hollywood Hills determine what the peons shall be allowed to hear or not hear, along the lines of Kim Jong-il. But instead of there being one dictator, Kim Jong-il, there are only three of them who are equal to Kim Jong-il. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Let's take a call out of New York, WOR. Joe, thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Yes, Michael. In the 40s and the 50s, the good guy was the good guy, and the bad guy was the bad guy. And the good guy always won because it was about the good. Now, the bad guy is the good guy.
That's right, because the spawn of Spielberg want to twist the minds of the children so they can turn them into putty and reshape them in their own image.
Absolutely. It's about the bad guy with the gun, with the hot chick, and that's what is very little intelligent dialogue. Because it's all about.
Well, okay, but you know, you can trace the origins of this to the 1960s with the hero worshipping of the anti-hero, okay, where Jesse James became the hero instead of the lawman who was pursuing Jesse James. And one of the seminal turning points in movies was a movie where Bob Dylan appeared in. Does anyone know what movie I'm referring to? Mr. Something and Jesse James. Does anyone know that movie? I saw it last night on the Western Channel, Joe. I like Westerns when they're superbly done. It was by Sam Peckinpah. It was an amazing movie. Bob Dylan appeared in it as like a weird guy called Alias. He said, call me Alias. Does anyone know the movie I'm talking about? This is an obscure, Well, who's mumbling in the background? It wasn't Woody Allen playing, so Woody Allen, for example, is considered a genius, but in reality, he's part of the Schlemiel machine that portrays everything weak, for example, about the American Jewish male. I don't think you understand what has happened there. I've been trying to tell you this for years on this show. It agonizes me. In the 1940s, there was a black actor who made a fortune by stereotyping black men as servile and stupid. And his name was, I forget, who was the black actor? What was his name? Stepan Fetchit. So Stepan Fetchit, people loved it because it was a stereotype of what black men is what they wanted them to be, servile and stupid. And it promoted that stereotype of black men. Do you follow me? Now we get to the 1960s, and along comes the Jewish equivalent of Stepan Fetchit in the form of Woody Allen. Woody Allen is the Jewish Stepan Fetchit. Again, white audiences love Woody Allen. Why? Because he portrays the schmuck, the Jewish weakling, the coward, the man who's bad with women who thinks he's so smart, the guy tied up in therapy, the guy who's always nervous, the guy who doesn't know what's going to happen. So that, again, is a stereotype of the Jew. When have you last seen an Israeli Sabra, a tank commander, portrayed in a movie? When have you last seen the Sons of Zion portrayed in a movie, as they are, the men who defend their nations in airplanes and tanks and with bullets and bayonets? Never. Why? Because the spawn of Spielberg only want you to see the weakling and the perverted and the warped. Why? You'll have to ask them what their end line is here. Because if you have to look around America, it can't get much worse. Take a look at the kids with the pants hanging down under their skinny, stupid behinds, aping jailbirds in prison. No belt. Jailbait walking around. Where'd they get that from? The spawn of Spielberg glorified it in the movies, in the music, the same thing. This is what goes on in a society. So it's a fundamental question that we're talking about today on the show, which is the czars of Hollywood. Why do they want to degenerate the average mind? They're not appealing to the lowest common denominator. They are creating it. And that's my fundamental point. They're not appealing to the lowest common denominator. They are creating the lowest common denominator. I argue to the contrary. I argue, looking at movies of the 30s and 40s of the type we've been playing today on the show in the Seventh Nation, that if we had films that were sure exciting, but they also had dialogue that was snappy and intelligent and portrayed heroes who were cops and heroes who were soldiers and heroes who were teachers and heroes who were the average American, the people would flock to that movie. You mark my words. The reason Abuse of Power is not being made in Hollywood is not because it wasn't a bestseller for 7 weeks. It's because Michael Savage wrote it, and the hero is a white male and is a Muslim bomb.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I'll be home for Christmas. It is the Savage Nation. Frank Sinatra with I'll Be Home for Christmas. Not as good as Louis Armstrong's rendition of some of the songs, but still good. We have been mulling some 1930s and 40s movies written by the great screenwriter Ben Heck. He's an amazing man. You should look him up on Wiki. But go down a little bit because the Wiki version is horrible. Don't look. Do a Google on Ben Hecht, H-E-C-H-T. And then bypass the Wikipedia one, because most Wikipedia entries are false and just written by cranks who hate people. But you'll see what he produced, how many screenplays he wrote. I'm asking why screenplays of the 30s and 40s were so much more literate when people had much less education. And we played some of the sound bites of that, and we've been talking about what the spawn of Spielberg produced by comparison and things of that nature. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. We'll take your calls on these and other topics. Before I take any of these calls, I want to remind you that I read a piece from my forthcoming novel, which will be out in about a year, a sequel to Abuse of Power. And I'm not, I live my books as best as I can. And so when I read about the Justin Herman Plaza skating rink in San Francisco in the last hour, which I visited last night. I love it. It's this time of year that I visit it, hanging on the rail and watching the children with their mothers and fathers, and I see them skating around the ice like little fledglings learning to walk beside their parents. I write it into the book because I realize that I'm living the book in some ways. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to stop an atomic attack in America the way Jack Hatfield did, but there are men who do such things. We don't know who they are because the only people shown as heroes are the drug addicts and the degenerates and the anti-Americans by the spawn of Spielberg. So let's take some calls on the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255, New York City. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I would be astounded if there was one single critic or two single critics who didn't consider Steven Spielberg one of the greatest filmmakers of all time.
Well, you're right about that. And in North Korea, Kim Jong-il was considered a genius in running a state. Anyone who criticized Kim Jong-il wound up in a death camp. Anyone who would criticize Steven Spielberg would not write another review other than on a blog in Alabama.
I'm talking about a movie maker, Steven Spielberg.
No, I know who you're talking about, but I'm saying you're saying that because critics laud Spielberg, that means that's all Spielberg is a genius.
That's, well, what more do you want?
Jim, do you recognize that there may be dissenting opinion as to whether or not he is a genius?
And for your information that he slurred American...
Jim, you didn't hear me. You've come with a predestined statement, and you made it. But I am saying to you, and I'm trying to make the point, that Kim Jong-il also was considered a great genius in North Korea, because anyone who disagreed didn't disagree for too long. It's the same in Hollywood. If you do not laud Spielberg or the spawn of Spielberg, you don't work in that town. Do you understand how it works?
Listen, I'm trying to talk about the...
All right, take a walk. All right, take your Geritol, whatever you take. Take something with a lot of iron in it. You know what I mean? I'm glad he's listening anyway. Houston, Texas, let's go to the South where more reason seems to prevail these days. Cheryl, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Michael. I'm calling to find out if you got any comforting news yesterday. I've been listening to you for an hour and hope you were going to report that you had some good news.
I do have good news, yes. I don't want to dwell on it, and I don't want to milk it and turn it into a Glenn Beck moment, so to speak. You know, with crocodile tears and tell you about the... Let's put it to you this way. I was worried for a few months because whatever it was inside my body that was not supposed to be there was growing instead of shriveling. And I'm not talking about my cerebrum. I went to and she said by what she had seen that this was just simply tissue, not any kind of cancerous tissue.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And basically, to come back in 2 months. No, I was very interested to learn that over the age of 50 in some men, this does happen, Cheryl. This does happen. But she said, don't assume that it's all as benign as yours appears to be. She said, I had a man, 51, who it turned out did have cancer of his pectoral muscle. It's amazing that what's being known today in medicine, some of the diagnostic tools are so great that perhaps this has been part of the human condition since time immemorial, but I don't think people knew what it was as near as 50 years ago in men. You know what I'm saying? Moreover, men would never have talked about something like this 10 years ago because they would have been embarrassed. I mean, men are worried about, rightly, about prostate cancer, and women are worried about breast cancer because that's generally how it works. However, in the case of men, they can have both. In the case of women, they can only have one of the above. I will tell you this, I have a lot more compassion for women's concerns in this area than I did before. It's a pretty big nightmare to think about something growing in your body that you have no control over. I mean, it's a pretty big nightmare, isn't it? But again, let's not go in that direction. I just felt obligated to tell you that it looks like I'll still be kicking around a little bit longer on the Savage Nation. I had my little scare for a few months, and she said, don't worry about it. God, I like women doctors. I have nothing against men doctors, but there's something about women doctors for a man that they're a lot more, for a guy, there's a lot more nurturing from a woman doctor. It's like a mother thing. I don't know what it is. It's like you want your mother to tell you, hey, here's a lollipop, go out and play. You know what I mean? Now you can go out and play. I got to tell you, okay, I'll give you a three-minute version. I took the day off. I had a 3:45 appointment smack in the middle of the first hour, couldn't go to do the show. So the young man who drives me got caught in a traffic jam and couldn't get me at the time he was supposed to get me. So I said, oh, my God, I had to jump in my car. I knew there'd be no parking in the city near this doctor. I raced into the city over the Golden Gate Bridge. I drove in circles for 30 minutes. I couldn't find a parking spot. You got to hear what's coming. And I had 10 minutes to go to get into the clinic to see the doctor. I was freaking out. I was contemplating parking on a sidewalk. I was contemplating calling the office and saying, can you send the secretary out? I'll give her $50 to sit in the car. I pull up next to a guy pulling. I thought he was pulling out in a van. Burly guy with a beard. And I said to him, sir, are you pulling out? He says, no, I'm sorry. I just pulled in. So I see he's a friendly guy. I said, I don't know what the hell to do. I said, I got a doctor's appointment in 10 minutes. He says, I know it's hell. He said, I drove around myself for 20 minutes. He said, well, maybe you'll get lucky. I said, I need more than luck. I said, I want to pick the right word. I said, I need a miracle or I need a blessing. I said, I need a blessing right now. I swear as God is my witness, right next to him, the car's engine started up. He said, oh, look, they're pulling out. You know, it was like parallel parking on a steep hill in San Francisco. And the person pulled out. And I got there just in time. I mean, you say, was there a parking blessing? Oh, no, it's just coincidence. I don't know. I don't know anymore about these things. But even in a little thing like that, okay, you can look in your life at little things and you could see God in everything. If you know, what do you think the song was? Every time I hear a newborn baby cry or touch a leaf or see the sky, what do you think that song was about? Now, when have you last heard a song like that? We're going back again to the movies where role models were noble, role models were heroic, role models loved America, role models were patriotic. The bad guy was a piece of garbage, deserving of nothing but the gutter and the electric chair, old Sparky. Take a look at what the spawn of Spielberg have done to the mind of America, the average mind. They have done to the average mind what Bernie Madoff did to the finances of millions of people. I'll be right back.
Savage.
For every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. I believe that somewhere in the darkest night.
So I grew up on the schmaltzy stuff. It made me into the man I am.
I believe for
I come out of a movie theater, I want to be the hero. I go into a movie, I don't go to a movie theater. I come out of a movie now, I don't know where to turn for salvation. Every movie is the same. A junkie, a whore, a depressive, a victim, a terrorist as a hero. It's sickening. It's crazy. And they won't stop. They just won't stop like madmen. They will only buy the dreck that promotes the anti-hero. The people are screaming for cultural heroes that they can believe in. They're crying for it. They're crying out for it. So, I mean, look, this has been covered before. There's nothing new in what I'm saying, obviously. But it's worth saying around a time like this, a family time and Christmas time. And so that's why we've been playing some of the sound from great movies of the 40s, 30s, written by the incomparable Ben Hecht. And I want to play, Beowulf, is there another good one that we can play from one of the movies that you got? Anything but Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney. Anything but Barack Obama giving a speech or Harry Reid. Anything but mourners crying in North Korea to get away from Gingrich, damn Repub. Anything that doesn't sound like Fox News or CNN is what I specialize in. Play another clip now from an older movie with great dialogue.
Hello, Duffy, get set. We got the biggest story in years. Earl Williams captured by the Morning Post exclusive. Yeah. And I want you to tear out the whole front page. That's what I said, the whole front page out. But never mind the European war. We got something a whole lot bigger than that.
Okay, what is that? It was quick. It was fast. Not exactly the best example of Ben Hecht, but... I still like the one from Scarface where the police chief tells off criminal Tony Camonte that he's a rat, and the rat's played by Paul Muni. Now, listen to the 1932 drama film Scarface, screenplay by Ben Hecht. Here's where the police chief is the hero and the criminal is the criminal. Listen.
Listen to me. You come into this town, you think you're headed somewhere, don't you? You think you're going to get there with a gun, but you're not. Get me? You know why? Because you got $1,000 bills pasted right across your eyes. And someday you're going to stumble and fall down in the gutter. Right where the horses have been standing. Right where you belong.
You got me all figured out, eh?
I've spent my life mixing with your breed, and I don't like it, get me? You can hide behind a lot of red tape. Crooked lawyers, some politicians with the gimmies, writs of habeas corpus, witnesses that don't remember overnight, but we'll get through to you just like we got all the rest.
Oh, maybe me, I'm different.
No, you're not. Take your gun away and get you in a tough spot, and you'll squeal like all the other rats.
Now, if only we had district attorneys like this who could go after the political class that has profited like Roman Caesars under Obama. If only we could get the FBI to break free of the shackles of the Department of Justice under Eric Holder, who should be impeached according to 90 members of Congress, and those who have benefited to the billions through the crony capitalism practiced by this breed of Democrats. Ooh, what a great country it would be. If only they could look into military appropriations. If only they could look into the solar appropriations. If only they could look into the Fannie and Freddie appropriations. Oh, if only we had such district attorneys in America today. Let's go to Sacramento. Rob, welcome to the program. You're on the air with millions of listeners.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. I just want to say thank you for reading that part about in your book about Justin Herman Plaza. I used to work there in the city a few years back, and up from the 32nd floor in Embarcadero number 1, I could see the skating rink during Christmas time, and it just brought back some good memories. And you know, that was about the time I started listening to your show. So,
well, that skating rink is my favorite. In fact, I go there from time to time now. It's my favorite time of year. It's only up for about a month, whatever the period of time is, 5 weeks. But to see the children and the parents, and mainly the mothers, teaching their little kids how to skate, it's an amazingly beautiful thing to watch. And I like the smell of the ice. Strangely, I took my dog, Teddy, there last week, and I put him up on the rail. It's amazing how he observed and was watching and watching, because it's almost a part of the animal kingdom, the beauty of the skating, the way the parents mentor the children in the skating. It's just something beautiful to watch. It's very hard to describe. But the reason I read that scene to you from my forthcoming novel, the sequel to Abuse of Power, is I wanted to make a point with my audience, which is that my novels now are reflecting to a certain extent, you know, what I see and what I hear and what I smell in my real life. The rest, of course, is fictionalized. If you missed it, I'm not going to read it again to you because it was well, I'll read it again because I wrote it last night and it's a part of my next novel. I have the time for it. So Jack goes into the city near the financial district in the next book, the sequel to Abuse of Power, and he says, blah, blah, blah. So he took the route to Justin Herman Plaza, where they created a skating rink similar to the one in Rockefeller Center in New York. 2 years ago, when Jack had broken up with Rachel in the fall, he had faced a lonely Christmas season. Since he didn't have a wife or family of his own, he would go to the rink and hang on the rail at night and watch the children with their mothers and fathers skating around the ice like little fledglings learning to walk beside their parents. He would watch with a vicarious contentment as a mother would place her little daughter in between her legs, pushing her around the ice with her knees turned in to prop her up. Jack marveled at how much it was like the animal kingdom. See, that was the line I liked the best, because I observed a mother doing that last night. Jack marveled at how much it was like the animal kingdom. At some point, though, he would usually have to turn away, his eyes tearing up, thinking of his own mother and how she had taught him so much, how to walk, how to dance, how to tie his tie, how to talk to a lady, among other things. Like most strong men, Jack never talked about her. What could he say that wouldn't sound sentimental and false? But her life had enriched him beyond calculation, and her death had hit him like a fist in the gut. And I remember when I wrote that last night, I actually had to turn away from the rink because I thought of my mother in the dark. I don't understand how these things work. But that's how these things work. Memories are made of this. Yeah. Memories are made of this. Well, I got loads of callers from Pittsburgh to New York to Hawaii on every topic imaginable, from the crony capitalism in America that has infected our political system along the lines of Kim Jong-il's North Korea. The only thing separating us from total chaos is the U.S. Constitution, which the gang on the left is trying to cut up into little pieces. And God forbid they should succeed that, because if they continue to attack the Constitution at the levels they're doing it, whether it be with ballot stuffing or acornites, you know, great dictators from little acorns grow. Gee, I wonder who I'm talking about. Great dictators from little acorns grow. Huh, it's an interesting line. And now a word from one of my sponsors, because I've talked to you about Envoy Medical before, because you know it's all about knowledge and legacy. And what you leave your children and grandchildren depends upon sharing your wisdom and experience. And it's one of life's most important callings. But what if you suffer from hearing loss? Well, this gift could be lost. And leaving that legacy requires effective two-way communication. There happens to be a medical breakthrough for those with hearing loss called the Esteem Hearing Implant. It's a revolutionary solution. It's 100% invisible, so you actually can keep up your active lifestyle. The Esteem Hearing Implant delivers a natural improvement to your hearing. It's a naturally clear sound. And you learn about this new breakthrough how, and how do you do it, and how do you give your children a legacy they'll cherish for a lifetime? You simply call 1-800-953-5453. Do you hear me? ENVOYmedical.com. It's that simple. 1-800-953-5453 or envymedical.com, ENVOYmedical.com. Do it today. Call 1-800-953-5453 or ENVOYmedical.com. For a list of side effects and benefits associated with Esteem, visit envymedical.com. Now, we will be back shortly right after this break that's coming up to play more sound, more of that incredible music I heard last night outside that German restaurant. And I had to go home and get the CD, and we downloaded Louis Armstrong and Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra just goofing around for Christmas.
Savage.
One of my favorite instrumentals, Sleigh Ride by Leroy Anderson. I play it in July. I played it last July in San Francisco, sitting in a pair of shorts. Couldn't wait for the Christmas season. It's the most beautiful time of the year. I love it here. I don't travel because why go away when things get nice? People become nicer and they're happier. I love observing people this time of year. Everyone's, are they really depressed underneath it all? Is that what, according to the Spielberg Spawn, everyone's really a molester and miserable, they're depressed. You know who's the worst portrayer of the worst of humanity? There's an actor, I tell you, I don't understand how he... forget it, why talk about it? I don't even know his name. I saw that... what was that movie I mentioned earlier that I watched last night on television about with Bob Dylan? Who? Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Bob Dylan plays a character called Alias in it. It's an interesting movie. Sam Peckinpah directed it. It's a pretty amazing piece of film work. Amazing. Just astounding movie. But you can only watch it for so long, and then it becomes, you know, like just a, the music's incredible in it. I mean, Bob Dylan, I think, wrote the music for most of the film, if not all of it. The songs are all his. So if you're a fan of Bob Dylan, I recommend it. At least that's when he was still, you know, performing at his peak, I guess. God bless him. He's still performing at 70. You know, it's because the musicians, they don't put their money away. That's why. It either goes up there or up there, and that's the end of it. They don't know how to hold on to a buck, so they have to, at 70, they still have to do a road tour. What do they think they are, a talk show host from New York? I don't tour. I could do tours. Sometimes I wish I did. I'm just reminiscing because I do miss seeing the audience. It's amazing. Okay, you have the big audience, but you never meet them, so you don't know if it's real. And you live alone in a room or you sit alone in a studio with a dog. You have no feedback. You run into a person here and there. They say, I love your show. I grew up on it. I've been listening for 10 years. I got to tell you, blah, 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 blah. And it's nice. But there is a, you know, there is something to be said for a live performance. And I could see why people do it. But, you know, I don't do it because of a number of reasons. And I don't want to go into them. But the fact of the matter is, I guess if you don't have to, you don't do them. But if you do have to, you do them, I suppose. I don't know how it works exactly. I don't like to travel. I don't like hotels and things of that nature, but I sure would like to meet all of you if I could. I sure would like to meet all of you if I could. And so that's why I, you know, would hang out in certain restaurants in San Francisco for a while. Part of it was the food. Part of it was to have the occasional interaction with people from Texas or Georgia. They'd come in and look for me, and then you get into a scene where you can't even digest your food. Everyone wants to be nice, and what are you going to do? You're not going to be nice to them. You can't be a jerk. And I like people. I genuinely like to talk to the people, but then I can't eat the calamari, so that's why I'm not hanging around in Italian restaurants anymore. Oh, the food's awful out. Is there any life out after an Italian restaurant meal? There's no food. Nothing was as bad as the Vietnamese, so-called, the ersatz Vietnamese lunch I had today. You can't believe this. I mean, I knew it was bad to begin with. It's like a bad Chinese restaurant. What's Vietnamese food when it's bad? Bad Chinese food. You know, when it's good, it's unique cuisine, obviously. I was in a rush. I had the dog with me. I wanted to take it out. So I got their famous, vegetable noodle soup. Oh, a nightmare. Bellyache for 2 hours. Did you ever take a soup home, put it in your car in the back, and by the time you got home, open it up, and the lid had dissolved into the soup? Can anyone explain to me what kind of lids they're using? There were plastic pieces from the lid dissolved in the soup. I got so angry, I wanted to call them, but I knew I'd get nowhere. Then I wanted to call the county health department. I knew the corrupt bureaucrats either weren't there or wouldn't do anything. So what are you going to do? I fished the plastic out and I ate the soup. It's awful. You know, and by the way, the ingredients, right? I'm eating a mushroom and I'm saying, I wonder if this mushroom came from the fine fields of China. Then I'm eating a piece of bok choy and I'm saying, I wonder how much, what level pesticide is in there? Probably enough to kill a hippopotamus, knowing that they probably bought the cheapest garbage they could get on the world market. So is it any wonder that I wind up not, I cook my own food or I go to one or two restaurants in the entire world? Oh, I got a winner here. Patty, you I can see it. I can't, Patty, where'd you come up with this? Okay, Patty in Mississippi, welcome to the Savage Nation. Fire away. You created this, right?
I was stunned you didn't come up with it on your own. I was expecting it to come out of your mouth any second now because it's...
Wait, hold it. Now, you know how I usually make up statements from dot to dot in one generation? This is all yours. Go away, Patty. It's your moment.
From Ben Heck to Pure Drek in one generation.
The spawn of Spielberg gave us the latter, not the former. Now, Patty, you're not supposed to be able to think as cleverly in Mississippi. It's flyover country for people like Sean Penn. How come you can still think down there?
Well, I'm barefoot right now, and so I think that might count.
You said you're what right now?
I'm barefoot.
You're not barefoot and pregnant, I hope.
No, I'm too old for that. No.
Well, Patty, have you read my book, Abuse of Power?
I have not. I have your other books, but I don't have...
Then I'm sending you a free copy for Christmas. It won't be there in time for Santa Claus to deliver it, but it'll be after Santa Claus. He's going to have a few days off, and Santa will drop it down your chimney next Tuesday, probably. Now, I have to plan now, because my family's gone away again, because I went away with them, and I said, I'm never again am I traveling. I never. To have a gangbanger run his fingers through my hair, no thank you. To have a gangbanger put an electric prod between my legs and strip me? No, thank you. Look what we've given up in the name of terrorism. Look at what we've given up. I mean, there's a simple solution to it. Wave everybody on except people who meet the racial profile of bombers. That's all. It's real simple. It's common sense. Do ethnic or racial profiling. You'll catch 99% of those who might be carrying a shoe bomb onto a plane. And please leave the grandmothers with leg braces alone. But then I don't run the TSA. Nice, hefty women with short haircuts seem to be prevalent at the airport, especially those who like to go inside the various and sundry of your underwear. And we gave it up. We gave it up in the name of security. And remember what Ben Franklin said about it. Those who would sacrifice some freedom for a little security wind up with neither. Thank you, Janet Napolitano, for fulfilling Ben Franklin's prophecy. You're everything Ben Franklin warned us against. Those who would give up a little freedom for a little security, a little more security, wind up with neither. You're telling me you have more freedom and more security under Obama? I don't believe so. You know the elites don't go through this because they have private jets, so they laugh at you. Congress doesn't go through this by and large. Not when they're hitching a ride on an Air Force jet. I mean, just take a look at what Nancy Pelosi did when she was Speaker. Only a G5 or better would do for her. Remember that? That never came to anything because, after all, nobody would follow that one up. And so, you know, we're living in very worrisome times. You see a dictator like Kim Jong-il dies, and you see it was massive starvation caused by the government taking over agriculture because they thought they could run it better than the farmers of North Korea, right? Sound familiar to you? Here you got a government that takes over businesses under Obama, and they say that they can run it better than the private sector. And you know they can't. You got Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac saying they can do a better job than private banks could. And so they gave loans to people who were unqualified for loans, and they brought our economy to its knees, while some say Franklin Raines and Jamie Gorella cooked the books and made millions. So what does it have to do with Kim Jong-il? Well, the only thing that's keeping the Democrat criminals from going even further and grabbing even more power and doing more damage to our country as their fellow travelers in North Korea have done is the U.S. Constitution. But the Democrats are doing everything they can to destroy our Constitution as well as fast as they can. They're the ones who want to eliminate Michael Savage on talk radio. They've done everything they can to smear me. So far, with God's will and your listenership, I'm still here. They tried to pass the Fairness Doctrine, if you remember correctly, and a few Republicans were quick to join them. I can even name them. Trent Lott was among them. Do you remember that? There were many Republicans who wanted to shut us up as well, because there's nothing better than a silenced media for a dictatorship to emerge. Nothing better indeed. I am actually a national treasure, and you should remember that. And your government should have given me the Presidential Medal of Freedom instead of putting me on a watch list, but they didn't. Instead of sharing sound clips with their degenerate leftist cohorts in the government, the ex-government of England, they should have nominated me for a Presidential Medal of Freedom, but they didn't. Instead, they have every miscreant they can get their hands on in the White House. That's the world we live in, and that's the world we have to live with. And let's pray that the people continue to understand the distinct dividing line between what Obama wants to give this world and what some of the good Republicans are reminding us this world of ours in America was built upon. It's as simple as that. There's a clear dividing line. Think North Korea, top-down government running everything from agriculture to your daily life. Now think of America. Think of America when it was at its best, when we were the most productive people on earth, when we were the rulers of the economics of the world. Freedom, freedom from red tape, freedom from bureaucrats, freedom from the little communists in your town who make you spend thousands of dollars to expand your house, tens of thousands of dollars, so the little bureaucrats can have a nice fat pension somewhere. Communism. Don't call them bureaucrats. Don't call them workers in your county. Call them communists like I do. Whenever I run into a contractor who shakes his head at having to face another bureaucrat in San Francisco, I say, don't call them a bureaucrat. Call them what they are, communists. That's exactly what you have in America now, communists in the government at every turn. Some of them are nice people. Some of you may work for the government and may be nice people, and I understand you're only following orders. Some of you may work for the TSA, and you're only following orders when you strip down that kid with polio. I understand you don't want to strip down that kid with polio. I understand you don't want to embarrass that old woman who's had a heart condition and cancer when you make her get undressed in a back room. I understand that. I understand when you wave the Arab onto the plane without inspecting his baggage, that it's something that comes from the top down. I understand you're only following orders. I know how it works. After all, I live in this country too. I understand that you're only following orders and you may be actually nice inside. I understand very, very well you didn't mean to humiliate that old woman at the airport. Well, all I can tell you is somebody made you do it, right? Or do you have free will? Hawaii, Mike, fire away. You're on the Savage Nation.
Mike, first of all, I want to say hello, Chief Infidel. probably more than any other talk show, you make your audience think. And so you were having a discussion with, strong characters from the old movies. And I think what makes your show so successful is that you have strong discussion, and you are a strong character. So I guess what I'm
Mike, you're living in Honolulu right now, or what part of Hawaii?
I am up on the North Shore, believe it or not.
Have you been affected by the great leader's wife and her visit to the island?
Boy, is that an understatement.
You mean they've closed down the H-1 freeway for the great leader's wife?
My commander-in-chief, so you have to understand I have to be very restricted in what I say.
I get it. Yeah. Okay, well, he's a great commander-in-chief. After all, he did get Osama bin Laden. You got to give him credit for that. He did end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Look how that worked out. That really worked out. Worked out well for the troop morale. I'll be right back on the Savage Nation.
You gone fishing.
How do you know?
There's a sign upon your door. Gone fishing.
Oh, real gone, Eddie.
Real gone. You ain't working anymore.
Well, it could be, you know.
There's your hoe out in the sun. Where you left a row half done. You claim hoeing ain't no fun.
I can prove it, though.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing by a shady, wady pool.
Shangri-La. Really loud.
I'm wishing. Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong gone fishing. Great songs. I mean, these guys were really wild men, and they were able to perform at the pinnacle of entertainment. Not a dirty word came out of their mouth, and the audiences couldn't get enough of them, right? Now, compare them to what we have today with the teeth, with jewels in the teeth, and the level of illiteracy. Compare what this country is. So it has a lot to do with the entertainment. So you ask yourself, is the entertainment a reflection of our society, or is our society a reflection of the entertainment? It's an interesting question. You know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? What fell first, the society or the entertainment? Or do they both go down to you-know-where in a handbasket at the same time? It's a very interesting cultural question. That's all I can say. Portland, Oregon. John, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike. The way I see it, I basically grew up with an actor next door to me who was a bit man for the 70s TV show. And I asked him why they spoke so rapidly in these old movies. And he said most of these actors and screenwriters and directors, they came off a radio and they had time periods where they had to meet their cues.
Bingo. Wow, that's brilliant. That's a brilliant insight, John. I never heard that before. That is amazing.
I love old movies to death. I mean, they're so much superior.
But how fast? I mean, it was like a machine gun, like a Thompson submachine gun. The dialogue, the speed at which they spoke, and people copied it. You know, in New York, people have already slowed down to the point where they're like a farmer in North Dakota in the 1950s. No one speaks as fast as I did when I was a kid. The whole society is much slower, whether it's a product of the mores of society have changed or the... I don't know the exact reason that everything slowed down, but they say fast as a New York minute. That has no meaning anymore. How fast are people in New York anymore? They're not really that fast. They used to be faster. I mean, they were quick and wit. They were quick and wit, and the dial and the words that came out of people's mouths was much faster years ago than it is today. Whether it's better or worse, I don't know. You know, when I first moved to San Francisco, I'll never forget this. I moved here in the early 70s, I believe. Right. I remember distinctly when I got here, 74. So I had the typical arrogance of a New Yorker, an expat, where I thought everyone was stupid because they spoke so slowly. And I was still speaking very quickly, even though I had done a detour in Hawaii for 6 years. It didn't affect my mind, as it does to so many people who go on to like the poi brain. They become incapable of speech and functionality. They sit under a palm tree waiting for a coconut to hit them on the head so they know what to do next. So I come here, and I have the typical arrogance of the expat from New York, and I met a very intelligent older woman. And I used to comment sarcastically that people were slow here because they spoke slowly, and she said something interesting to me that I learned from. She said, just because they speak slower doesn't mean that they're not smarter. She said, why don't you listen to what they say? And you know what? She was right. Many people who speak slowly are incredibly smart. And many people who speak quickly and eloquently are not that smart. Look at the teleprompter man. I mean, you know, how much further do you have to go than that? So don't assume because people speak slowly they're not smart, in other words. I learned. I also had to learn to slow my speech patterns down for radio. I got to tell you that. This is not my normal speech pattern. It's not like I'm controlling it to a great extent, but I'm altering it for the sake of radio so that you feel that you're having a natural dialogue with me, because if I spoke as quickly as I did to my friends and when I was a kid in New York, you wouldn't understand half the words I said. I would sound like a Spanish language TV star as you're flipping the channels. That's a quick language, right? You think Spanish is a quick language? English is faster. It's just to a non-English speaker, English is almost indecipherable. People can't even follow it. It's like da 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 da, right? Anyway, we're talking about language. It's fascinating. There's nothing more important than language. It's all there is. There's nothing left. Oh, and right, you can teach old dogs new tricks. You ready for this one? This you're going to love. Remember I told you the other day before I took the day off for the doctor that I was walking in the mall and there was Chinese guys in suits and they were all over the country pushing an opera and they must be spies for Beijing. Remember I said that? Remember that? So I stop at the kiosk, I think yesterday, and I speak to the guy. I said, oh, I don't want it. It's just Chinese propaganda. He said, no, it's the opposite. I said, what? He said, this opera that we're promoting is put on by the same people who put out this great anti-communist newspaper all over America, whose name I forget right now. I said, you're kidding me. I love that. The Epoch Times. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. He said, we are pushing a traditional view of China before the communists took over. We're not talking about peasants or warlords. We're talking about the traditions of the real China before Mao Zedong destroyed it. And I said, oh, my God. And he tried to explain to me. I said, well, you sure taught me something today. And he went on and on and on, invited me to the opera and this and that. So I'm saying you can teach old dogs new tricks. And sometimes it is worth listening to people, even people like me, who you may not agree with at first glance or at first hearing, because you think I'm something that I'm not. So there's a message in everything. Merry Christmas!
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
This is Louis Satchmo Armstrong talking to all the kids from all over the world at Christmas time. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that Saint Nicholas soon would be there.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let yourself be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.
There's a fascinating article today that I posted on michaelsavage.com, linked from The Atlantic, about how Kim Jong-il starved North Korea. This comes on the same day that Jimmy Carter, the communist, sent a note of condolences and respect to the crazy son of this lunatic who starved his country to death. The article explains the origins of one of the world's greatest hunger crises, and it all has to do with centralized planning, government control, elites running the food program, exactly along the lines of what Obama is trying to do in America, surrounded by his Stalinist cronies. So there's an argument on the blogs where they're trying to control the dialogue and saying, how dare you be a conservative tarring progressives as communists? And he says, in the United States, it isn't the government leaders that have the highest standard of living. It's the business people who have rigged the system in their own favor. So someone writes back, who rigs the system for them, genius? Criminals like Barney Frank and his community banking friends to whom he steers bailout money, and his boyfriends at Fannie Mae. Obama has repaid Wall Street for giving him more money than any other president in history by bailing them out. Obama and Steve Rattner, the guy who bribed New York State pension officials so he could make millions managing pension money, bailed out their cronies at the UAW with our money, and they have done nothing but lie about the financial results. GE, they write, run by Obama's buddy Jeffrey Immelt, barely pays any income tax, but they make billions selling wind turbines to buyers who are using subsidies from the government. The political class is the wealthiest segment of our society. Warren Buffett invested $5 billion in Goldman Sachs and publicly stated that he did so because he knew the federal government was going to bail them out. Now the Fed keeps interest rates at essentially zero. It devalues our currency, which devastates the little guy trying to save for retirement or his children's education. But it allows Obama's cronies on Wall Street to obtain capital for almost nothing. I'll go on because it's amazing. The crony capitalism practiced by Democrats is repugnant. Solyndra was a payoff to Obama's liberal friends. Kleiner Perkins is full of limousine liberals who make hundreds of millions of dollars in investing in green industries that only make money because the liberals in state and federal government subsidize them with the tax dollars of the producer class. as opposed to the idiots who were able to take a month off from their cushy unionized government jobs to occupy the Wisconsin state capitol. People like Tom Daschle spend decades increasing the size and scope of government and then cash in as lobbyists by selling access to the monster he helped create. Daschle's wife made millions as a lobbyist while Daschle was the Senate Majority Leader. Where the heck did Charlie Rangel acquire the millions of dollars worth of real estate and stock that he failed to report in his financial disclosures? Dianne Feinstein sat in a military appropriations subcommittee that awarded companies controlled by her husband over $1.5 billion in government contracts. Nancy Pelosi and her husband invested in credit card companies, and she then provided passed favorable legislation for those same companies. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac brought our economy to its knees while Franklin Raines and Jamie Gorella cooked the books and made millions. The mayor of Chicago even cashed in on Fannie Mae before he didn't let the crisis that he and his fellow idiot liberals created go to waste. The political class in this country in Washington and Wall Street are all limousine liberals who depend on the support of the dishonest and ignorant like Mr. Miller. That's the writer of the other blog. And then this writer concludes. There isn't a dime's bit of difference between Kim Jong-il and Obama and his Marie Antoinette wife jetting around the world on five-star vacations, spending scores of millions of dollars, while the average Joe is worried if he'll keep his job. The only thing keeping the criminally incompetent Democrat politicians from doing as much damage to our country as their fellow leftists have done to North Korea is the Constitution, and they are doing everything they can to destroy that as well. How's that for a reader of an article who knows what's going on? Another guy writes, ideas matter. To those in the community of intellectuals who propagate tribalism for the greater good, you should live in the countries where your ideas, when accepted and carried out, lead to such misery. In doing so, you might feel enough shame over the horror you engender to change your ideas. No, it wasn't intellectuals who killed millions in North Korea, but their ideas accepted by millions and carried out to the logical end by despots did. If it weren't for their ideas about collectivism and their sophistry in foisting it on people, this nutjob would have been placed in an asylum long ago, where he should have been all along and where he would have died with no mention. To those intellectuals who gave rise to Kim Jong, it's time to change your minds at the full recognition of the fact that life really does matter, and there is none more precious than the life of the individual. You can read this article on michaelsavage.com. Carter sends condolences to North Korea, how Kim Jong-il starved North Korea. You have to read it. You have 2 days left to buy Abuse of Power for the Christmas holidays. I'm telling you how to do it. You can go on to michaelsavage.com. You can order now from Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or go to your local bookstore. It's not Hemingway. It is much better. This is a book that you cannot put down. So start early in the day and it will be a day well spent, said a reader who read the book. There's incredible reviews. It's a great book, a work of fiction that is written that is not afraid to go against the political correctness of today. There's so much more. And I suggest that you go to michaelsavage.com or amazon.com and get that book right now.
You know, this is what happens with communism. It's a great concept. On paper, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. But once you put a human being in power, it shifts. We saw it in Russia. We've seen it all over the world. It's nuts. But I keep my fingers crossed.
Wow, you know how much that irritates me? Well, imagine how your throat will get this winter without Pine Brothers Softish Throat Drops. That's right. I'm talking about Pine Brothers Softish Throat Drops we all grew up with. They're back in natural honey and wild cherry flavors. Pine Brothers has been a trusted brand since 1870. Visit them on the web at pinebrothers.com. That's pinebrothersyum.com. Also in the news today on the Savage Nation, plenty of news, by the way, great picture of Obama with pizza. House GOP goes wobbly. You're caving into Obama. Was Bo flown back for a photo op with the president shopping alone? I don't know. Maybe he was on Air Force D. There's Air Force One, Air Force Two, Air Force Three. And then maybe another Air Force 747 or a 777 for the dog. We'll call it Air Force D. All this and more. By the way, don't miss this. Jimmy Carter, crypto communist, sends condolences to Kim Jong-un. Can you believe this man? Can you believe this man? All this and more on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every cup who tries to stop. Rocking around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring.
Now, I believe Freud's theories about sex are as relevant as ever. And so, although some of them have undergone revision, many current psychologists think that the founder of psychoanalysis was completely wrong about everything, and everything backwards, and they've tried to undo what he did. It's part of the deconstruction of Western civilization, by the way. By bringing down Freud's theories, so they think, they can bring down and collapse all of Western civilization and completely turn civilization on its head. There are certain things you can't change, and you cannot take a giant and turn him into a Lilliputian, particularly if you yourself are a Lilliputian and not a giant. The fact of the matter is, sexuality has a central place in our psyche. So you say, well, okay, I don't want a college lecture today on the Savage Nation. I've heard all this, or I haven't. I'm not interested. Talk instead about Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum. I don't want to do it. I mean, I am so bored of politics right now. You know, what'll be will be. Whoever runs will run. When the election comes around, I'll talk about it, right? I'm not going to talk about these, you know, who's going to run now. I mean, I'm not on Fox News where that's my bread and butter. I think that I would rather talk about something positive, which is, if you're driven by sexual thoughts or urges, how have you sublimated them into something positive? I think that's what's important to think about. Not whether you're sick, okay, but how have you channeled your hypersexuality, so to speak, into something positive? Okay, that's an important discussion, because I would argue that all of civilization is built upon sexual energy, if you want to take it from a strictly... I am probably strictly, from a psychological point of view, a Freudian in that regard, even though I'm not a therapist at all. I never pretended to be, nor do I want to be. But if you were to ask me what school of psychology, Savage, do you follow, it would be Freudianism, because he was a giant. He was the founder of psychoanalysis. But even he had his limitations, and he acknowledged it. Even he once said, if I remember correctly, that not everything was about sex. And he once commented, you know, he said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Okay, so let's not get carried away. You know what I'm saying? He understood that there was a limitation even to his theories. Now, I know many of you don't agree with Freudianism, but that's really not what the show is about right now. It's how do you use the energy, your sexual energy. New York City, WOR, Nando, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, you know, I'm a psychologist in New York City, and I agree with you that Freud was a giant in a lot of ways, but he did get some things backwards. For example, he assumed that the disturbance was sex-based, but a lot of people get disturbed first and foremost about other things like ego, their status, their anger, their rage. And then they employ all kinds of methods to...
Well, let me see. I'm not here to dispute you because you... Hold it. I'm not going to dispute because you know more about it than I do, but I want to see if I can follow your ideas. You said that the anger and the rage control them, but what drives the anger and rage is what I'm interested in.
I think from a modern cognitive behavioral point of view, it's the stuff they tell themselves. You know, you and I can look at the same situation, and we tell ourselves different things. If your premise is one of, let's say, an unconstrained vision, you're more liberal. If you have more of a constrained, tragic view, you're more conservative. So both of us can look at the
Wait a minute, I like it. That was pretty glib of you. Wait, yeah. I want to hear that again. Let me hear that again. That was beautiful. Let me hear it again and see if I agree with it.
Well, this is a theory that's been out there, I guess, for like... sort of dozen years or so, which is that some of us have sort of a tragic view of life, which is that there are constraints on the world, you can't have everything you want, and those people tend to become conservative.
Hold on, let me think about that. I have that viewpoint, but I don't think that's why I'm a conservative. But okay, now give me the liberal viewpoint.
That's one factor. But then another factor is if you believe I can have it all, in fact, I deserve it all, and somebody should provide it, otherwise the world is... wrong and unfair towards me, then you tend to become more liberal.
You mean that the world owes you a living, in other words?
Yeah, right. Now,
all right.
So people...
But I would just add to this, since we're getting into the strictly political, that I was speaking with a boatsmith today, a man who came out and fixed some wood on my boat today. He's an expert in mechanics. And we were working together. I mean, I was watching him. He was taking out broken screws and fixing a broken rail. And he's a businessman, and he said to me, every businessman he knows on the Sausalito waterfront is ultimately a conservative politically because they don't like hyper-regulation, and they hate high taxation. And they all love my show, is what he was saying. So in other words, even though they live in this liberal area of San Francisco and they work on the Sausalito waterfront in the boat industry, anyone in business recognizes that big government is against them. I don't think that has anything to do with emotions or sexuality.
But that's right, and people can get disturbed and then use sexuality. But even there, you know, if you have a moral view which is everyone should be equal, then you're going to view injustice as anything that makes more money for one.
Well, I don't believe that. I don't believe everyone can be equal.
Right.
All we have to do is look at a basketball game and understand that there are some people who are better at basketball than others.
Right. Well,
okay, and then I apply that to every sphere of the world. You're not going to take everyone and turn them into a nuclear physicist, for example, or a surgeon. That's absurd. That's absolutely the communist point of view. And you know that went on in communist China after the revolution, which is what scares the heck out of me and makes me sick when I listen to these unrequited leftists who tell me that every moron in America can become a brain surgeon if only they were given the chance. That's utter nonsense.
I agree with you. In fact, that's called the moralistic fallacy, that because I might be disadvantaged in some way, it's wrong, and therefore it isn't so. That's really a fallacy that says that if it's wrong, it isn't so, and that doesn't follow.
Well, look, you're a psychologist, and I have sympathy for educated people in this field, but I want to ask you, said Freud had it backwards. Tell me how he had it backwards.
Well, he had it half right in that sex, really, not sex evolved to get our genes into the next generation. So in that sense, he was correct. But he said that he made these fixed rules about these stages that you have to go through, and that if you didn't properly go through these stages, then you'd be messed up in life and have a...
Oh, what, the oral, the anal, the phallic, et cetera? Yeah, that whole theory?
I think he made all that up. And but the reality is that when people get disturbed of various sorts because they put themselves down, or they put others down, or they put the world down, they get enraged, or they get grandiose, then they're so upset that they use different means to appease themselves, whether it's more regulation or hurting others or...
But what about in Freud's view that sexuality as the causation of all neurosis? Would you agree with some of that, or all of it, or none of it?
I think you got to be very careful. I mean, obviously, sex is important in the sense that it motivates a lot of what we do. Now, a lot of that is unconscious. He was correct about that, because let's say if I study painting or something, I'm not consciously thinking that this is going to get me laid. On the other hand, it might help me get that.
Well, what do you think people go to museums for?
Yeah, right. So.
I'm joking, but how many people that are in museums are there to meet somebody? You have to ask yourself, you think everyone's there just to look at the paintings and the sculpting? The Navy SEALs are some of the best men in uniform that America has. Obama may have taken credit for killing Osama bin Laden, but these brave men and women are the ones who deserve the credit. I should say brave men. I don't know of any women in the SEALs, so let's stop the PC already. Joining us right now in the Savage Nation is Navy SEAL Chris Kyle, author of American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. Chris Kyle, thank you for your service. You're a true American hero, and welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's definitely great to talk to you.
What made you decide to write this book?
Actually, I wanted people to understand not only the service members, but the families and all the sacrifices that go in or part of any deployment. You know, when I deployed, my wife was basically a single mother, raising two kids, taking care of all this simple day-to-day life stuff that stresses people out, but now doing it on her own and also having to worry about her husband. And this isn't something unique to me. This is every service member goes to this who is married, or not even married, you know, mother and father. The second reason was Ryan Jove and Mark Lee. They are two true Americans who died for their country, but they didn't get the Medal of Honor. You know, one got a Silver Star, the other one got a Bronze Star. so you don't hear their story. So I want to make sure to get that out. And lastly, I know writing this book is going to give me a voice. I have an agenda. I am an advocate for veterans, and there are different things I want to help these people with. Whether they come home and they're having problems, I want to help them in every facet of their day-to-day life. Or if they don't come home, I want to help take care of the widows.
Will you tell my audience on the Savage Nation some of your best and worst experiences as a combat sniper?
You know, some of the best experiences are just when you see your training takes over and, you know, your guys are just rocking and rolling in the middle of combat and spirits are high and it's getting to be, you know, it's a day-to-day event. You get shot at every day and we're sitting there laughing, making jokes, cracking at each other while you're in the middle of this firefight. That and then just the strong brotherhood that you have with these guys. You have a new family now, and it basically becomes your number one family because you're away from your other family so much. And then some of the worst experiences are, you know, being up there feeling helpless, not able to protect a Marine or, you know, a soldier that's down on the ground or even one of your own that dies right next to you.
What made you decide to join the Navy SEALs?
I grew up always wanting to be in the military. Honestly, I wanted to be a Marine. That's back when there wasn't a whole lot of hubbub out there about the SEALs. Didn't know hardly anything about them. So I went to go join the Marine Corps, and Marine Corps recruiter was out to lunch. So the Army recruiter pulled me over, told me about the SF, and I thought, okay, that's great, but you had to wait to be a E5 before you could go. I left his office, and then the Navy recruiter pulled me in, said, well, if you want to go right now, you can be a SEAL. So he told me about what they were, and I thought, you know, that's awesome. You don't ever hear about these guys. They're out there doing this great job. I want to do that.
Well, I know you can't give us the details, but can you describe what the most dangerous mission you ever were on?
We went to the Army that we were working with, and they were going to be doing a block clearance. They had a city block pre-designated that they were going to go through, clear every house, check for insurgents, for any weapons caches that might be involved. And these guys have been there. They've had our back. They've supported us, getting us in and out in their area that we were working in. So we went to them and said, hey, how about we help you out now? You know, this will free up some of your guys. We'll go in. We'll take a portion of that city block so you're not so stretched in. And, you know, if you do have extra guys, you don't have to take everybody out. So that's what we were doing. The first building we took down, I went up to the top on the roof to take a sniper overwatch position. Ryan Jobe was standing next to me, covering a different angle. Everything was going flawless. The guys were taking down buildings. I was covering them. When they got to a certain point, took down the next tallest building, they were going to call me down. I was going to go up to the top of their building and just kind of keep leapfrogging there. Before it could get too far, a single shot rang out. And it felt like, you know, debris or something whizzed past my head. We all dove down, which when you dive down, it's a little too late, but natural reaction, jump for cover. As we waited just a few seconds, popped back up, tried to identify the direction and where the shot came from. Maybe we could see someone moving. Ryan was still down. Ryan was a new guy, and he was also my automatic weapons gunner. I hollered at him. I said, hey, quit screwing around. Get up. Let's try to find this guy. Still wouldn't get up. Now I'm thinking, you new guy, come on, quit being such a little sissy, get up. I go to walk over there, and that's when I found out he had been shot in the face. He actually got shot through his rifle because he had it up at the ready, went through his rifle, came out, hit him in the right eye. It didn't kill him. As I'm trying to apply first aid to him, I call out over the radio, man down, man down. A corpsman comes up there, immediately starts to assess the situation. We decide we got to get him downstairs and extract him. The only problem is the entire stairwell is exposed. to the same direction the shot rang out of. As we're getting him ready to move, I throw him up over my shoulder to get him down. Mark Lee stepped up in the exact same spot where Ryan had just been shot and just started mowing down cover fire, trying to protect us as we're taking him down the stairwell. I get halfway down the stairwell, and Ryan starts choking. I set him down. We start to assess the situation again, and then he decides he is not going to allow himself to take anybody else out of the fight. He's going to stand up, and he's going to walk the rest of the way out. And they extracted him. We finished our clearance, went back to our FOB, the forward operating base, and we started assessing the situation as far as what had happened, trying to check out any intel, any chatter that was coming. They came to us and said, look, we've got intel. We know where this guy is, but we need to go in with a clear head. And we all decided, okay, let's do it. We went into this building. It was a two-story house surrounded by other houses. As we went in, immediately we started getting shot at. The house was empty. I'm assuming it was bad intel or a setup. As we're stacking on the stairs to go up and take down the second story, our backs were exposed to a second-story window that the neighboring house, there was an insurgent up there with an AK taking a bead on us. Mark Lee stepped in between us and that guy, raising his rifle to take that guy and also trying to warn us of what the danger was behind us. He never got it out of his mouth. He took a single round and killed him instantly. We continued the clearance of the house. Once it was cleared, we called in the Army. They brought their Bradleys, their tanks, made sure the area was cleared, and extracted us.
Well, what effect did your extremely dangerous job have on your family?
As far as we were told, there's a 95% divorce rate in the teens. And I was not immune to that. My wife and I, several times almost, decided to call it quits. Luckily for me, both of us never gave up on the marriage at the same time. We both, you know, give up at different times, decide this is it. Luckily, and my wife's a super, super strong woman. Thank God she decided to stick it out and keep fighting for the marriage. And it was just the constant being gone and, you know, not knowing what was going on. And then all of a sudden finding out, okay, you're here doing this and, you know, scaring the crap out of her. But, you know, luckily we toughed it out. We went through marriage counseling and we had a great counselor. First started going, I was really scared thinking, oh, great, it's going to be a woman and she's going to tell me how wrong and how bad I am. Well, the funny thing, we went in and it was a guy and I was thinking, okay, little nitwit, he's still going to tell me I'm wrong. First thing he did was he started getting on to my wife saying, okay, you need to work on this. I was sitting there thinking, okay, when can we schedule our next visit? But everything worked out, and we're, you know, no longer in marriage counseling. Getting out definitely caused more anxiety with us. You know, I resented the fact she wanted me out, and it was hard enough trying to go from being a SEAL, not only that being my job, but that's who I became. That was my identity. To now all of a sudden, I'm going to have to be a civilian the rest of my life, trying to deal with that. And luckily, you know, it all worked out, and I got my mind straight. One of the things that helped out was, you know, I started working out again. You know, and that took away a lot of that depression of it's a evil little cycle. You look in the mirror at yourself and find out, you know, you look like a big fat has-been of what you used to be. Then all of a sudden start working out, getting back into shape, looking in the mirror like, okay, I can deal with this now. So you start fixing your mind. And, you know, that's one of the programs we've started now is there's a company called Fitco here in Plano that we're starting to put gyms into veterans' homes. People who either don't live close enough to a gym, they can't make it there, or guys who don't want to go to a gym and get stared at because maybe they're disfigured or, you know, they're not in the shape they used to be in, and you got these gym rats in there, muscle heads, and you don't want to have to be in there defending yourself with why you're a fat piece of crap now. So, and once you turn guys' lives around by getting their bodies back into shape, it's a lot easier to deal with the stuff going on emotionally.
Where can we read more?
American Sniper. You know, it's, and initially when I was writing the book, I did not want the number in there because I don't want, this book is not to glorify me. This is not about how great I am. This book, when you read it, you should come out of it saying, look at all those tough guys that I was working with. And, you know, it's easy to look like a hero when you're surrounded by them. And there's no way I could ever have done the job I did if those guys weren't standing right there with me. And people like Mark Lee and Ryan Jobe, willing to sacrifice it all just for the love of the brotherhood.
Chris Kyle, Merry Christmas, and thank you for your service to the nation. And thanks for joining us today on The Savage Nation. Good luck with your book, American Sniper.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, and again, thank you for having me.
I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
Said the night wind to the little lamb, do you see what I see?
Do you see what I see?
Way up in the sky, little lamb, do you see what I see?
Do you see what I see?
A star, dancing in the night with a tail.
Lion of the Desert, old movie, 1981. It's stunning. It's an amazing film. Anthony Quinn, Oliver Reed. But the director was an Arab. I think he was Iranian, Mustafa Akkad. He was a director-producer. Phenomenal movie. Rod Steiger as Mussolini in the opening scenes is worth the entire film. The glory, the glory of the settings, you know, the imperial settings of the fascist dictatorship are fantastic to watch. Just fantastic. And the dignity of his opponent in this Bedouin, this Muslim Bedouin, played by Anthony Quinn, as I said to you, Lina, that is astounding. A guerrilla fighter, in other words, Omar Mukhtar, Anthony Quinn, who committed himself to a war that cannot be won in his lifetime, meaning he knows he can't win against the Italians, but he fights them to his death, 20 years in the hills and in the deserts. And as I, again, as I say, when they are about to hang him, when the sentence is given down to him by the guy who plays the General Rodolfo Graziani, Oliver Reed, he says, I will outlive the hangman. He said, then you will have to fight my son and my son's son and then my son's son's son because you will never occupy our land. And he said, no country has the right to occupy another country. So, you know, it so resonated in with me. This movie, I wouldn't say it changed my view of the world. I mean, I've had a pretty clear view of what's going on in the world prior to this. But the fact of the matter is that if you actually think that we're going to subdue the Afghanis and make them into happy camel burger proprietors, you know, what do you envision, a chain of camel burger stands in Afghanistan? You're going to take these tribal people who are living in a thousand years ago, you're going to turn them into Burger King, or Camel King, whatever? It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. So there's much more at stake than this democracy movement in the Middle East. I don't really believe that's it anyway. It has to do with many other geopolitical elements that we know nothing about. Oil, opium, you can name it and pretty much figure it out. But it has nothing to do or very little to do with the, bringing democracy to the Middle East, because look at what happened in Iraq. That's democracy? You call Iraq a democracy right now? Ask the Christians who are dying in Iraq if it's a democracy. You talk the Arab Spring is the spread of a democracy? Take a look. Ask the Christians in the Coptic Christians in Egypt if it's a democracy that Hillary Clinton and George Soros and Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski have instigated. So as I say to you, you know, let's look at things clearly. I don't know what we're doing there anymore. I didn't know what we were doing there 2 years ago. I said we should get out of Afghanistan, incidentally. I'm on record anyway having said that, so I'm not going to change it all of a sudden to make you think I said something else, because it was a zero-sum game. There was no winning there. It's known as the graveyard of empires. And the fact of the matter is our empire is in such trouble right now We don't need to be another one of the empires buried in the graveyard of Afghanistan. You know, these wars have bankrupted this country. You just analyze the cost of Iraq. How many trillions of dollars did it cost us to give the Iraqis their freedom, so-called, to liberate the Shia Muslim from the Sunni oppression? How many trillions did it cost us, and what did we get for it? Tell me what we got for it. Did they give us so much as a barrel of oil? In a previous book of mine, I called for reparations from Iraq. Bush lied when he said at the beginning of the outset of the war, rather, he said, we will get reparations in the form of oil. They didn't send us one free barrel of oil. In fact, they stabbed us in the back after they were liberated in Iraq, and they gave the first oil contracts to China. So where's the reparations, and let alone the men who came back in caskets or in pieces or lost their bodies and their souls in Iraq? We haven't gotten anything economically from those people. Why? Where's the will of our leadership to say, you know what, you owe us money, it's overdue, it's $3 trillion, and we want oil, and we're taking it, and we have the military to do it, and if you don't like it, you know what, let's meet you on the battlefield. We're just taking the oil and siphon it right out of Iraq. Get the $3 trillion that way. You want to straighten the budget out? You can do it with Mexico, too. Mexico has the fourth largest oil reserve on the planet, the last I checked. It can be piped across the border. Why don't we demand reparations for the high social costs that the illegals have leveled upon us for the last 20 years? You want an equation? There's an equation. One barrel of oil for each illegal per year. There you go. You want a budget deficit straightened out? Now, Michael Savage, plain talking, plain thinking. Okay, I understand what needs to be done, but there's no political ability to do any of this because by the time you wind up in a position of Senate, at the Senate level, you're already so compromised, there's no way to ever hear a word of truth come out of them. Which brings me back to the radio show. After all, I'm not a politician. I'm only a radio talk show host. This is only one man's opinion. You've got to understand that. And many stations don't like very heated dialogue anymore. They're afraid of it. They want... They want something much more moderate in tone. They want something that's more, easy listening. Easy listening. No criticism of the government. No criticism of Obama. Look the other way. Strap on your rose-colored glasses. You know what I'm saying? Well, I can't help it. I'm too far into this to become somebody else. And I know that I represent the mind of the American people. Do you want me to become a more mellow mic? You want me to become a more mellow talk show host? I could do that.
Savage.